I want to welcome all of the recent arrivals to the ashram who have come for a spiritual retreat. Hopefully you've come to attain the supreme liberation and will not settle for anything less than that, because that is who you are and what you are and what all of this is. And all it requires is letting go of all the false beliefs that have been accumulated and cleansing the whiteboard of the mind so that there are no limiting preconceptions that interfere with the realization of your divine nature. So there's really nothing to gain, only to let go of the unreal so that the real is fully emergent and recognizable and is realized as what you have always been. So for those who have recently arrived and who may not be familiar with Sat Yoga, it may be important to stress that yoga is not Hinduism. And when we use the word Shiva, we're not worshiping a Hindu god. However, the Hindus, which of course that name itself was given by invaders, and it just means the people living by the Indus River Valley, are not really members of a single religion, but of a hodgepodge of very different belief systems and mythological systems that got compressed and often confused, occasionally well integrated by certain wisdom schools within that culture. But when we speak of Shiva, what we mean simply is yourself, your real self. And Shiva has always meant the zero point, the absolute essence of that which is unmanifest, but is the cause and the power that enables a world to be manifest. And the presence and the power of Shiva pervades that world, but invisibly, unless your third eye is open, and then all you will see is Shiva in a beautiful dance of cosmic dimensionality and a play of incredible beauty and intelligence and transformative power, which offers the ability to act in that play in a heroic role in which the sanskaras or the tendencies of the consciousness become transformed. And you, through that process of taking on the character of a server of God and a manifestation of that presence of the God self within and recognizable without, are able to let go of any traces of fear and any traces of aggression, any traces of suffering, any traces of anxiety or depression or sorrow of any kind, because you are freed from the illusion that the world is real and that there is anyone actually to suffer, since the innermost consciousness that is the experient within each being is in fact Shiva, the one self. There aren't many selves, there is one self. And once you have penetrated through the illusory ego identity, and even through the deeper level of the soul, which carries the light of God, and once it is awakened, surrenders and is reabsorbed into the God self, once that absorption has happened and there is complete liberation from any identification with a sense of duality or otherness or alienation from the one self, then all of the powers and the potentialities of the God self become accessible as the information and energy flow that moves through the consciousness and spontaneously moves the body and the mind to actions that are in accord with the will of God, of that Supreme Intelligence, and therefore in harmony with the cosmic unfoldment, and therefore all karma comes to an end. The illusion that there is an individual who makes mistakes and does things that create backlashes and glitches and the need to learn from trial and error. But a different mode of ongoing learning takes place at a level of consciousness in which there is open access to the deepest levels of understanding, both of the internal and the modus operandi of the other, and of the trajectory of the unfoldment of the world process as a whole. So this is what yogis discovered thousands of years ago, and because of that, yoga, the word means union, union with God. Sat is a word for God as the supreme level of the real, of beingness. And that God self can be known impersonally and as well as the supreme person or personhood. And both in a panentheistic way of seeing all within and moving and having our being within God, and God pantheistically animating everything in the universe, because everything is consciousness, everything, from the minutest quantum to the largest galaxy or nebulae or supernova in the cosmos. And these various beings and manifestations have their movements all coordinated, even though that cannot be recognized or understood by the finite level of intelligence of the ego mind. And thus the goal of augmenting and increasing our intelligence until we return to unity with that intelligence of the God Self, either through the willpower of total stability in stillness, or through surrender in love to that self as if God were an other, but uniting through love and adoration until that otherness is overcome by the sense of union. These are the two paths, jnana and bhakti, knowledge and devotion. Either one will get you to liberation, and ultimately both appear, because the heart wants to surrender in love and the mind wants to realize and become fully empowered. And the harmonious unity of mind and heart are the way that achieves the goal. So today, in that calendar of Indian religion, this is what is known as Mahashivaratri. It is the high holy day of yogis and of Shaivites who are of that strain of Hindu philosophy and Vedic culture and thought, who have that understanding and worship of Shiva as an aspect of their religious belief system. But we are not approaching it as a matter of religion, but as a matter of psycho-spiritual recognition of our true nature. And the mythological systems developed by the yogis in that ancient time period of the oral transmission of the Vedas, which have since then had many strata of further mythological development. And in later times, the mythologies became weaponized in battles between believers who preferred to call God Shiva and those who preferred to call God Vishnu or Brahma or the goddess, one of the names of the goddess, or of some other deity in those mythological forms that their imagination created. But the self that we are referring to is the source of imagination and not an object that can be worshipped. But the wisdom that enables one to access your absolute self has been very subtly transmitted through mythology. And so I want to speak a little bit tonight about the seven major myths that underlie Mahashivaratri. But to do this not in a way of religious belief, but of understanding how these myths relate to you personally, because that's their significance, not about something that happened long ago. And when you study the myths and the religious theologies and cosmologies of all of the world's religions, what you discover, fascinatingly, is all of them are congruent. There is no difference in the belief system of a mystical Christian or a Jewish Kabbalist or an Islamic Sufi or a Taoist or a Buddhist or a Vedantist or a Shaivite. All of them have exactly the same concepts, but using different terminology, different signifiers. But the signified is identical. And once that has been recognized, then one realizes that often the best way to study one religion is to study several others and see the angles that their equivalent conceptualizations offered that can help understand the subtlety of a different set of terms that are pointing to that which cannot be conceptualized. And so the process of psychospiritual development is a process of the maturation of our intelligence and the overcoming of primitive drives to remain based in an identity with the physical body and with the projections that were installed in one in childhood and one's role in the family system of childhood, and then the ways in which one was indoctrinated in the educational system and the social order and by the media and by whatever religious indoctrination one also received and whatever political and other social kinds of movements and attitudes and orientations and styles that were encrusted onto the identity to make one feel like one was well adapted to the social order. The problem for beings in the time we are living now is that most have, especially in the West, have been indoctrinated into an atheistic, materialistic, consumeristic, superficial, deregulated in terms of gender identity, in terms of the traditional values of the social order, and have been basically thrown into a nihilistic morphogenic field in which most of the messages that we receive are extremely anti-growth, anti-spirituality, anti-love, realization that there is more to life than the egocentric mind can offer. And that life in the past was always about a hero's journey to climb the mountain of God consciousness and realize the self. But life today has been, according to the way most have been trained, simply a phenomenal plane ordeal of a world of suffering in which you want to have as much money, as much power, as much status, as much fame, as much of the phenomenal plain capitalistic order can offer, which, as we approach the exhaustion of that order, cannot offer anything any longer of value. And this, of course, leads to an anxiety that most are attempting to deny and suppress, but once it has erupted in your consciousness, you realize that a change has to be made in order for you to be able to tolerate living in your own mind. And especially if that mind is identified with your body, and then it becomes hard to live in your own skin because it's filled with anxiety and anger and self-hatred. The problem for every ego mind today is that the ego is disloyal to itself. It's in an internal war with itself. How many of you can relate to that? A few, okay. Well, that's good. Before you leave, you'll probably relate to it a lot more, and you'll either be sorry you came to realize there is an inner war going on, or you'll be glad to know that there is a way out and a way to overcome those warring tendencies. But the internal war then gets projected as external conflicts with others and disloyalties in relationships with others and in schisms and breaks and breakdowns and in various other forms of suffering and despair, disappointment, and a feeling of often of being an imposter and of being empty and living in a meaningless world without any internal rudder to know how to live and what to live for. And the answers to these questions can only be found within, not from hearing it from anyone else. Because to the ego today, no one else has any credibility. Whether this speaker has any credibility for you is probably, for one side of the war, maybe it has some, but not for the other. And so therefore, there is always a double reaction to any new information. One that wants to tune it out and repress it and stay in the comfort zone of the old paradigm, and another part that wants to break through into a much more vast consciousness and power to bring one's creative freedom to bear in one's life, to make one's life a work of art. So let me write quickly the seven things that I took notes about earlier today. So in case my mind suffers, thank you, from dementia, I'll read it from this note. First of all, for those of you who don't know Sanskrit, Ratri means night, and so this is the night of Shiva. Maha is great. There are actually 12 Shivaratris in the year. Every month has a Shivaratri because it happens in every cycle, and the world is made of cycles within cycles. But there are four major Shivaratris, and they represent the four quarters of the circle of time. But there is only one Maha Shivaratri, which represents the culminating moment of the cosmic unfoldment to its total climactic ultimate revelation and redemption. And that's one of the meanings of this day. But I would like to change the name, and instead of Maha Shivaratri, I would like to refer to it as Shivarana. Those of you who know that the name of this mountain that we're on, we have called Arunachala, because it is also the mountain of God that is sacred to many Indians, and our patron sage Sri Ramana lived in Arunachala, that mountain. Achala is a word for mountain in Sanskrit, but it also means the immovable. Aruna, which also has a number of meanings, but its main meaning is the light of dawn. So the mountain of light. But instead of the night of Shiva, then Aruna, Shivaruna, would be the dawn of Shiva. So what I want to emphasize that for yogis is important is that we are leaving the dark night of the soul, the dark night of history that we have been in. And although the world will seem darker and darker in the coming days, if your third eye is closed, that darkest moment is just before the dawn, and those whose eye of Shiva is open will see the light first, because you'll be on the summit of the mountain and you'll be able to perceive and be filled with that light. So that's the metaphor. And it is the urgency of getting to that point where you can see the light, so you're no longer disturbed by the darkness that is the work of Sat Yoga. So in that case, this we'll say this is the day of. Let's see. Okay, I hope my handwriting is not too bad. So, the seven meanings of Shivaruna. First, we can say this is the day of stillness and silence, because Shiva is the stillness of consciousness at the very core of our being. And when we reach that stillness, we go beyond time. Stillness means no movement, therefore no change. And so it is the shifting from chronos time via the kairos immediacy of presence into the ion or the eternal present that is always here, but is usually covered over by our obsession with change and with doing rather than with being. So, the day of stillness. It is the day when all will become still. It is symbolizing that day when all will be in that Shiva consciousness. The second is the day that symbolizes the Vinash. The word Vinash means destruction in Sanskrit. So every religion is apocalyptic. Every religion says that at the there will be an end to time, and there will be a great destruction of the world, and then a return of the kingdom of heaven that will follow the annihilation and the return of souls to God. You know, in the Christian tradition, there are two teachings about the kingdom. One is that the kingdom will come at the end, and it will come as a thief in the night, and you won't know, but it will come and bring an end to the world, but rapture and redemption to the faithful. But if you go back to the early Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels of Rav Yeshua, Jesus, the teaching was the kingdom of heaven is here now. It's spread out before you, but you don't see it. And it's that aspect of the teaching that we're celebrating on Shivarana. The presence of Shiva is here now. The light is here now. It's always here because it's the eternal presence. But do you see it? Is your own consciousness open and attuned to that light? That's the question. So there will be a destruction, but it's only a destruction of a world that has become evil, that has become alienated from peace and harmony and goodness, and a world that is based on the heartless destruction of other peoples and other beings who do not serve the goals of one's own ego, whether on a collective or an individual level. And Shiva consciousness is nonviolent. And it's the renunciation of aggression at the subtlest levels of anger and of self-attack within the ego that is what is to be destroyed. The destructiveness must be destroyed so that goodness can re-emerge. So that's the second. The third, of course, is it's the day of the revelation of God consciousness as our true nature, and therefore the redemption of our consciousness from a hell realm of internal conflict to that of peace and bliss. And the fourth, Shiva, the original meaning of Shiva is the zero point. If you go to an accountant in India, they don't use there any longer the zero. They use a dot and they call it a Shiv. But if you read or see mathematical equations that are written by Indians in Sanskrit, the Shiv, the point, the dot, represents zero. And it was only after the Mughals invaded India and discovered Shiva, which was represented by an oval stone like we have here in our central mandala, which is referred now to as a Shiva Lingam, but represented a candle flame, which is also that elliptical form. And it represented the zero. And so the Arabs, when they went westward, they brought to the Western culture the zero. And that revolutionized Western technology, because until then, there was very little they could develop. Roman numerals are very hard to work with. If you want to, build a skyscraper, you have to have access to higher mathematics, and the zero is the key to being able to develop mathematics that will then be able to enable you to fly a rocket to the moon or beyond. So the zero was the key point. And the West couldn't get it because to the West, the basic doctrine is that God is one. But for India, no, God is zero, not one. And it's a huge difference in one's psycho-spiritual orientation that comes out of that shift. So that's one aspect of it. The fifth one is the Tandava. And actually, there are two Tandavas that are, it's a dance. In fact, this statue is of Shiva dancing the Tandava on the head of a dwarf, which signifies the ego. And there are two Tandavas. One is the Rudra Tandava, which is a dance that creates such energy in the macrocosm that you see there's a circle of fire. That ring of fire represents the world that will soon be going up in flames. But Shiva remains completely immune and undisturbed, and then dances the Ananda Tandava, which is the blissful form of the dance that yogis want to dance, which is the dance that brings the kingdom of heaven again. So this day celebrates the culmination of that dance, the climactic steps. The sixth meaning of Shivarana is that this is the wedding day of Shiva and Shakti. The two aspects of God, masculine and feminine. And the feminine represents Mother Nature, the phenomenal plane and the beauty of the world and the beauty of life when it's lived as a divine being. And so it is that beauty, that joy, that grace, that harmony, that unity that fills the world when the goddess in her total luminous goodness and love, in that state of the goddess, reunites in the wedding chamber with the transcendent source of the world who remains unmanifest. And that wedding leads to the withdrawal of the manifest, of the goddess, into the unmanifest, but then what is born from their union is a new manifestation of another world, a world of divine beauty. So we're at that moment of death and rebirth of the world and of the cosmic principles uniting again from having been separated through the dualistic illusion that every consciousness has suffered from in this past age. So then we have the final meaning, which is the day that I wrote there, poison swallowing. There's an interesting myth in India. I think it's the central myth, which is the gods and the demons are at war and they decide to settle their differences with a tug of war. And so they get Ananta, who's the snake that represents eternity and infinity, and wrap the snake a few times around Mount Meru, which is the central holy mountain of the world. And then they begin to push and pull, and the mountain turns like a washing machine, and the ocean of consciousness is stirred up through this back and forth between the divine forces and the demonic. And what comes out of this ocean of consciousness at first is all the negredo, to use an alchemical term, all the poisons that the ego has been carrying, all of its aggression, all of its anti-libidinal forces, its hatred, its fury, its weakness, its cowardice, all of that. And Shiva does the very generous act of swallowing the poison, but he doesn't let it go below his throat, but his throat turns blue as a result of this. And so Shiva, one of his names is Nilakanta, which means blue throat. And you'll often see mythological images of Shiva in that way. And once the poison is swallowed, it is turned into nectar of immortality, the Amrita. And then out of the ocean of consciousness emerge the ultimate benign archetypes of the goddess and of the powers of the divine forces that enable the victory of the divine over the demonic. So what does this represent? In every one of us right now, there is a battle between what is divine within you and what is demonic, whether you're aware of it or not. And the demonic at this point is more powerful than the divine, because the poison of the ego's sense of worthlessness and disappointment and fury at not getting what it wanted and all of that has turned the mind into a war zone. And a kind of paralysis between these two forces that create a blockage of the will to know how to move forward in life in a flow state. And instead, it's in a deadlock with itself. And it cannot choose to transcend the ego, but it does not want to fall into the total clutches of the demonic. So psychologically, we refer to these two forces as the upper death drive and the lower death drive. You know, Freud discovered the lower death drive, but he didn't discover the upper. And the problem is that most egos don't know about or have any capacity any longer to connect to the drive to transcend the ego, to go through ego death into God consciousness. And when they reach a state of despair and self-hatred and of nihilistic hopelessness, they fall into suicidal tendencies. And this is why you see an epidemic of suicides, whether through overdose or through violence or through joining wars and conflicts and expressing one's violent proclivities in a way that results in self-destruction. And so the yogi is one who gives all of the margin of will that we have to the upper death drive so that we can overcome those tendencies to fall into passive aggression, hostile dependency, and into the meaninglessness of an egoic life, in which the best one can hope for is to be an object of desire of another, and then to usually be extremely disappointed and dumped and left devastated. And this is often what precipitates people's being caught in the lower death drive and not being able to get out. And so we have a situation in which tragedy has become the dominant theme in the egoic life, and a sense of hopelessness and helplessness, because they don't have access to that divine power to overcome the lower death drive. And it requires a tremendous dedication to the discipline of silencing the mind and opening the heart to love of that supreme power in order to raise us up out of the quicksand of the ego, which tends to fall into self-destructiveness. And as we go closer and closer to the omega point, the dark demonic energies outside are becoming stronger as well. And so it is of extreme urgency to overcome them while that possibility is still a reality for you psychologically, rather than falling into such a state of agony and hopelessness that you can no longer even make effort to get out of it. And this is why for many, what Shiva represents is the last resort, the last hope, because there is no other way out except through that surrender to what is real within you, and to overcome the ego's fantasies and its projections and introjections and its illusions of pseudo-autonomy that are simply a state of inertia and rejection of growth. So that's the sermon for the evening, and I will leave it there. And because we have a much more to offer this evening, including the bhakti side of the yogic endeavor, in other words, devotion through music. I think tonight I won't open the floor for questions, but we will have opportunities to talk about anything that is unclear to you in the course of your retreat. And I'm sure you'll be able to ask senior yogis here to clarify anything I've said that is ambiguous or unclear to you. So one last thing I want to say is that Mahashivaratri, or Shivaruna, as we're calling it tonight, is in a way also an introduction to the next major retreat we're offering, which is, I think we titled it The Mystery of Evil and How It Is Overcome. And because we are in a time when apparent evil is dominant both within and without, it is very important to have an understanding of what is meant by that term and what within us corresponds to a level of our being that is anti-self, that is self-attacking and self-defeating, and that does not allow the breakthrough into the infinite nature of our being, but keeps us hemmed in a very small, petty state of egocentricity. And so the overcoming of evil requires a paradigm shift that is realized as literally a different way of seeing reality. And the next retreat will be about how that way of seeing the real is actually much more clear and simple and resolves all of the inner conflicts and makes one recognize that the external conflicts are also within the jurisdiction of that God consciousness that is overcoming evil, and that we are not in danger of being defeated by the dark side. But to overcome what will seem like a very precarious situation, personally as well as collectively, the opening of our consciousness to that higher reality is of extreme usefulness at this moment. So that's the reason why I think that retreat will be one of the most important shifts of the trajectory of the consciousness of those who participate. Because the overcoming of that duality of good and evil, which in the Bible was the beginning of the fall, right, eating of that tree, is what will lead us back to the tree of life and back to a world of love. So I am going to leave the floor now to our Shiva Bhakti singers, who are going to lead us in some songs that we can join in that may actually help your own spirit rise out of any negative state in case you, anything I have said has caused you to fall into such, or whether that was already latent and active in the consciousness. And through a reconnection to your God self, in whatever way you can imagine and feel connected, whether you wish to refer to it as your Buddha nature or Allah or your Christ consciousness or simply the emptied out ego in which there is presence in its purity, you don't need to have any belief in order to feel love. And so the music is about opening the heart to love and using the energy of adoration of oneself to connect to that which is highest and purest within you in order to free yourself from any identification with anything negative or unworthy. So I'd like to invite the musicians to come up. And some of you have received, I think, handouts, yes, with or will receive them, with the lyrics of the songs that will be sung. And I hope that you find it enjoyable. And don't be shy or inhibited in joining along or even in dancing and flowing in an ecstatic state. We believe in drunkenness here, if it's of the divine madness sort. So take it away, Shiva singers. And namaste to you all.
Feel free to get closer if you wish. And yogis, I sent you lyrics. Namaste officially.
Namaste.
Namaste. We're going to be sharing a few songs from our sacred song repertoire. So Sangha, you'll know them very well. We selected Shiva chants, so we don't need to say much more. Shani just gave the beautiful jnana about the meaning of this night, about the meaning of Shiva, especially that it's not necessarily about a Hindu god, but it's about the ultimate self or any name you wish to give to that supreme being. And as Shanya said, this is an opportunity to increase that upper death drive and to connect to your true self, your higher self, and in devotion, stimulate that adoration, which hopefully will then be a beautiful dance with Shiva. The first three songs, we invite you to call and respond. So I'll call, or Hanuman will call, and you can respond. And then the last song is just a joyful sharing. You do have the lyrics. It might be a challenge to sing along, but you can try. And this was a song that Shani wrote the lyrics to, especially for Mahashivaratri. Please, as Shani said, don't be shy. Feel free to let your voice ring. We'll all have our voices together. And on a night like tonight, I'm thinking of all the other beings in the world who are also probably singing very similar chants. So we can connect to the whole world right now.
Let's start by bringing our voices together with three ohms.
Mahadeva Om, Mahadeva Om.
Namah Shivaya.
Shambho.
So as I mentioned, this final song is an offering, and you could soak up the wisdom and the jnana by reading, if you like, and listening. But if you feel called and you want to join in, you're not, you're allowed. Shiva continue to waft up the flames and get on that upper death drive. Thank you all for your love and participation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste. Namaste.
before everyone gets up.
It's a wrap.